Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jesse Collings, and joining me once again, he's coming to us from the Lone Star State of Texas. It is Joe Lanza. Joe, welcome back to the show.
I'm here. I'm always uncomfortable with being announced from being from Texas. I don't feel
a native Texan, Joe Lanza.
Yeah, exactly. I don't feel like I'm from Texas, but I do make my residence here, like the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase would make his seasonal residences in various parts of the country and the world. But yes, I am here, and I also have no idea why I'm here or what the show is about.
Yeah, Joe has been a trooper. He was up all night watching Wrestle Kingdom, then did live audio with Rich Wrestle Kingdom review show, which people can listen to now by the time they're hearing this. Then he went to bed. Then he woke up this afternoon to do this show with me. And then he is subsequently doing another Wrestle Kingdom, or Wrestle Dynasty, rather, live audio show, which, again, will probably be up by the time people listen to this. So you are just, you're watching wrestling, you're recording pods, and you're getting a tiny bit of sleep in between. What is your wife doing during this time period?
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's a banker, so she works on Saturdays. So she went to work today. And she woke me up when she got home because I told her I needed to be up to come do this fine podcast. And she's just keeping the kids at bay and making sure I have peace and quiet so I can work and do things like this.
What a woman.
She's tremendous. Tremendous.
So I'm having you on the show today to talk about John Cena. And I thought this would be kind of fun because it's John Cena's, you know, last year in wrestling and starting, you know, this year as the recording this on January 4th. And you know, when we've talked and I've had you on the show before, you know, we've talked about mostly contemporary issues in wrestling. We've talked a little bit about like ECW history and things like that. We've never really talked about John Cena. And I wanted to say, like, I actually don't really know your opinions on John Cena at all. You could be a secret, huge John Cena fan. And I have no idea because he hasn't, for as long as I've known you, he hasn't really been like an unbelievably relevant figure in wrestling. You know, he's come back and done, you know, sizable matches and things like that. But this is a guy who, when I was a kid and when I was, you know, when I was coming up as a fan of wrestling and started talking about it online, John Cena was the pivotal figure in almost every single conversation that I had online. It's kind of incredible to think back, then and then look at today and think that he's hardly mentioned a lot of the time. And that's because he obviously doesn't wrestle that much. And I'll start by saying these two things for me. The first is John Cena was my first real favorite wrestler as a kid. When I first started watching wrestling when I was like 9 or 10 years old, John Cena was the wrestler who I really, really liked. That was obviously when he was on his rise. He was, you know, on his way to winning the WWE Championship for the first time from JBL. His white rapper gimmick was a very popular to 9-year-old Jesse Collings. You know, he was from Massachusetts, which obviously was a bonus. And he was a cool guy. Joe, do you have like the first wrestler you can remember like being a real big fan of when you were a child?
Yeah. And it changed a lot in those years, but I think the first one was probably Junkyard Dog around 1984, 1985. And then from there it evolved into Jake the Snake Roberts was a big one. And then Kurt Hennig. Those were the big three when I was a kid.
Yeah. Like I think the Undertaker maybe was my first real favorite wrestler, but by the time I was watching wrestling, like the Undertaker was kind of like an ingrained legend at that point, as opposed to John Cena was like the new top star guy. And so there was a little bit more life in John Cena. I remember going to SummerSlam 2006 at the TD Garden, where it was John Cena versus Edge. And absolutely horrible, horrible booking for this. They had been doing the gimmick where Edge was the champion and Lita kept getting involved in his matches and costing John Cena the title. So they did this gimmick main event. It's in Boston. You know, if Lita interferes in the match, Edge loses the title. So what happens? The referee takes a ref bump. Lita interferes anyway. Edge wins. So everyone just went home super, super pissed. And then, of course, the next month in, I think it was in Toronto, in Edge's hometown, they do a table ladders and chairs match, and Edge loses. So both fans in Boston and Toronto saw their hometown fan favorite lose and went home mad. So that was excellent booking by Vincent Kennedy McMahon. But he was my first favorite wrestler. And then subsequently, he was also, I think, the wrestler that taught me about like how to be a smarky fan, how to argue about stuff online, how to go against and boo the people that the company is pushing. And you know, as I got older and his character got more boring, and you know, I obviously drifted away from I became an adolescent, and when you're an adolescent, you often don't like what you liked when you were a child. I became a big anti-Cena guy, not like a full-blown crazy anti-Cena guy, but someone that was really exhausted and tired by his endless push within WWE and his lack of character growth. But he was the guy that I think like really shaped like the way I would eventually become like a blogger and podcaster about pro wrestling. It's all from the conversations around John Cena. You came up in like the letter writing era and the newsletter sections and things like that. Do you remember like who your first like real wrestler that you got like heated debates about, like, you know, whether it was reading people's letters in the newsletters or things like that? Like, do you remember like who was like the trigger for you?
Yes, I remember many nights by candlelight dipping my quill pen into the ink to scroll a letter to David Meltzer and his Wrestling Observer newsletter publication, which hopefully would arrive by the
Pony Express
rustic methods of delivery to my home while the wife was churning butter and hopefully the children weren't dying of rare diseases. So yes, I came up in the letter writing era of the wrestling fandom. But what was your question before I went into that bit?
Just like, who was like the first wrestler that you can kind of remember? Like, not like, I think triggered is the bad, isn't necessarily a good word, but like triggered to like really debate about like the hardcore circles.
Okay. Well, the Smarks hated Hulk Hogan.
Right.
Okay. They couldn't stand Hulk Hogan or the WWF. He would be the one where, when I was coming up, when I was a kid and I was reading the After Mags and Pro Wrestling Illustrated and all that, the three world champions were Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, and Rick Martel, because the AWA hadn't really slipped into the depths that it would a few years later with like Larry Zbysko as world champion, where nobody put him on the same level as the other ones. But it was those three guys when I was really in my formative years as a kid. And even in places like that, which were a little less smarky than the sheets, mm-hmm. The fans seemed to favor Flair and Martel over Hogan. Hogan didn't represent real wrestling. He didn't represent pure wrestling. He represented Vince McMahon's bastardization of pro wrestling and Vince McMahon's circus and all of that. So I think there's probably a lot of parallels to John Cena, a generation later.
Right. John Cena was a bad wrestler, right? He would get hit with those "you can't wrestle" chants. The thing about Cena, to me, looking back on it, in here's a general hypothesis I have with Cena's career. I think John Cena is the last like traditional pro wrestling star. I think he is the last guy to kind of come up and be developed in a traditional pro wrestling sense and get over and be pushed immediately as a tip-top star in American pro wrestling. You could say it's different in Japan because the model is different, in Mexico because the model is different. But John Cena, to me, is the last true, like, traditional pro wrestling megastar that was developed using a traditional formula of, like, we're going to introduce this guy. We're going to, you know, start him off in the lower card, put him up in the mid card. We really believe in him. There were times when they didn't, but for the most part, it's a pretty clean story of him getting introduced, getting elevated, and then eventually getting pushed as a world champion and him really taking off as individual star. I feel like subsequent to John Cena and that kind of era, once you get to the next era of like post 2010 or so, the way people became pro wrestling stars was just very different. Maybe that's just my own experience and kind of the way my age fits into that nicely.
Well, I think that mirrors stardom in other forms of entertainment.
Cena is a ubiquitous mass media star while everyone else is a niche star subsequent to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the biggest music stars today with the biggest hits are unknown outside of Taylor Swift, who is a completely different animal.
Taylor Swift has also been around for like 15 years.
Yeah, so. but you know, the others are largely unknown outside of the specific audience that they're geared to, because, you know, we're less exposed to. It's easier to not be exposed to things you don't want to be exposed to these days. Mm-hmm. You know, we were having a conversation in our Discord the other day about stand-up comedians, and somebody posted the list of the top five touring stand-up comedians of 2024. And a bunch of people who were in on that conversation and comedy fans didn't know like three of the names on the list. And it would be preposterous in, say, 1985 to have anyone who didn't know who Eddie Murphy was. Yeah. Like, he was just so famous that it was just impossible to not know who he or you know. But so I think John Cena may have been the last of the pro wrestlers to where culture was more wide, you know. So I think that might have something to do with the point you're making.
Now, from a business perspective, from a sellout perspective, from a live, let's see, we can use live attendance because it's kind of the easiest era to era comparison tool. I was reading in the Observer that you know, WWF's attendance in 2024 was, or WWE's attendance in 2024 was the highest on average that it was since like 2001. And the era that they're in is really the most successful era that they've had. Financially, it's the most successful era they've had ever, but really from a comparative standpoint, it is the most successful era since, you know, the Attitude Era. But do you feel like Roman Reigns is as big of a star as John Cena is in wrestling?
No. No, I right. do not. Simple answer. Simple short answer, I don't.
Do you feel like Cody Rhodes is as big of a star as John Cena was in pro wrestling?
From the standpoint of selling tickets, drawing ratings, selling merch, probably not, no.
Right. And Cody's probably a better example because Roman works infrequently. So
yeah,
it's kind of hard to pick and choose. But Cody's and the Roman kind
of
guy.
Has a decade of not being able to become a star, which kind of adds a stink to any analysis of him that I think in some ways is a little unfair, but yeah, has to be acknowledged.
Yeah. I'm thinking more intended. Just like, I'm almost asking just more like on vibes as opposed to like,
a
pure analytical analysis of it. Just, it felt like Cena was, you know, you have, if you want to talk about, like, we can go back even further, but like talk about like, okay, Bruno Sammartino, the company is entirely built around Bruno Sammartino. That is the WWF formula, straight from Vince Sr., right? And even before that, you can talk about like Argentina Rocca and people like that. But really, it's like Bruno Sammartino, he's our top babyface champion. Everything is going to be built around him. He's going to main event all our shows. We're going to have this gallery of challengers that are going to come in and work with him. And that's our formula for 15 straight years. And then, of course, you know, it passed around Pedro Morales, then it's Bob Backlund, and, you know, obviously then it's Hogan. And then once you pass Hogan, you get Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And then, of course, Austin and The Rock. And then you get to, you know, John Cena, basically. And it is this through line of how WWE does business and how the overall philosophical approach to how to build a wrestling company. That is like the ideal model for a wrestling company. If you ask like almost anyone, even people that have, you know, consumed a lot of wrestling outside of WWE, it's like, how would you build a wrestling company? It's like, you get a big baby face and you push them really hard.
Yeah.
But subsequent, because I think, you know, they pushed Roman for so long and it didn't really take, and then they turned him heel, and then that kind of took, and they needed to find someone else to be a baby face. It just feels like WWE is kind of beyond that model now. They've found a different way to do it. And I feel like the way people become stars in other companies, whether it's AEW or even, you know, international companies like New Japan or CMLL, just a little bit different. It's hard to draw direct comparison to that traditional WWF model, which was the model that I feel like you looked at when you thought of a pro wrestling company.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, didn't they attempt that with Roman though?
Exactly. Yeah, they tried to repeat it with Roman, but it just didn't work. I think times had changed. Yeah. And also the creative was poor, and also Roman was a bad fit for the role that they designated him for. So there's a lot of other factors. The difference is they just kept trying with Roman, as opposed to in the past when they had tried with people like the Ultimate Warrior or Lex Luger, they gave up relatively shortly compared to what happened with Roman. And that has to do with your financial changes of the company.
And I guess your point now is that because they're probably never going to go back to that model, Cena would be the last of that type of pro wrestling star. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
And that's what makes this – so this is his last year as a wrestler. I'm really intrigued by what he's going to do. But let me get your thoughts. Like, what was – like let's go back to like let's go back to like 2005, right? John Cena wins the world title from JBL at WrestleMania. Batista and Triple H is the main event of that show. You know, Raw is the A show, SmackDown's the B show. And very quickly, that's kind of switched. Like John Cena goes to Raw, Batista goes to SmackDown, and Cena is clearly positioned, I think, above Batista as like the main future drawing star. At the time, do you remember like what your thoughts were about John Cena? Were you watching?
Yeah, I was never. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was never part of this smart brigade that hated John Cena, especially when he broke through. Cause by then I was already deeply into my smarkdom and insider era of my fandom, and it was obvious to see that this guy had a clear upside as to be a huge star, you know, with the ruthless aggression stuff coming in. And I had been following his career through developmental, and then like you said, the white rapper gimmick. It's like, all right, this guy's gonna be a top guy. It's undeniable. So maybe I was viewing him through a slightly different lens than a lot of people who were first being exposed to him on WWE TV. But I never had this hatred towards him that you would expect a smark from that era to have. I was never an anti-Cena guy, even during the Five Moves of Doom era, right? Like, I didn't.
Well, I was going to get into that later because I think it shifts.
Yeah, I apologize if I'm jumping ahead, but even during that era, while I didn't think he was any kind of super worker, and there were obviously flaws in his work, I wasn't put off by the guy like a lot of other people seem to be. You know, so I don't know. John Cena has never been a wrestler that has annoyed me with his presence. And as you know, I am very easily annoyed by the presence of a lot of pro wrestlers. And John Cena was never one of those guys for me, even if I was never a big fan either. I've always been mostly agnostic and ambivalent towards John Cena.
Mm-hmm. There's a, I think for me, and obviously this probably coincides with my age because I become a teenager at this point. By the time I really became like a true smark, once I kind of started, you know, understanding more about the wrestling business, by the time I was like 13 or 14 years old,
I
started going online and seeing other people's comments and stuff like that and being influenced by those people, I was definitely in like the anti-Cena brigade, but it was never really like a personal dislike of Cena as much of it was frustration with the WWE product in general and the inability to change Cena's personality in any way.
Cena wins, that stuff.
Yeah, that stuff bothered me more than anything, especially they would introduce someone with potential or they'd be interesting and then Cena would just beat them. And Cena's character at that time, like I said, I was interested, like as a kid, I gravitated towards the white rapper gimmick. And then his character just like devolves into just being like a generic babyface. There was a military cosplaying phase, but then he just became like the bright colored shirt wearing guy that didn't really have a personality. He was kind of like a smartass, I guess. He was a good promo and he was charismatic and he could get his catchphrases in. But like, what is John Cena's personality from like 2009 to like 2014?
Well, he was the kid you went to high school with who was the white rapper in high school who grew out of it. That's what he was. You know, I almost feel like he was a matured version of that character.
Sure.
Because it's kind of, you can't be a 35-year-old aspiring white rapper.
You should talk to some people I went to high school with. They would disagree with that.
So. Right, but how do you view them versus when you viewed them when you were 18? Right, when they were 18, it was like they're cool and they're trying to do something.
I get what you mean.
You get the point I'm making. But when you're 35, if you're still holding on to that, it's like, all right, well, this guy, you know, he's a fucking loser, right?
Yeah,
like, Cena was almost an evolved. He was an evolved version of the same persona. I thought during the what color T-shirt is he going to wear with his little hat era of his career.
Yeah, which of those T-shirts was your favorite?
Are you kidding? Why are you kidding me? What is this? I'm half asleep and
did you own any John Cena merchandise?
Yeah, I had a bright red one with the "You Can't See Me" fucking logo on it. No, like I said, I wasn't some kind of Cena super fan. I just didn't have any dislike for the guy. But here's the thing: I understood why other people did, because it was a very monotonous time to be watching WWE. Because again, LOL, Cena wins, and like you're saying, as a new, fresh, you know, blossoming smark, you're seeing people like Umaga probably and all these other guys, and you're like, yeah, let's get something fresh and new in here. And it was always, you know, Cena staying on top.
Yeah. And like, unlike you during this time period, I am not really watching other wrestling. Like, I'm not watching Pro Wrestling Noah. TNA comes on TV right around this time period, probably like 2006, like that, at least when they go to Spike. They were on Fox Sports since before, but that was when I first became aware of TNA, was like 2006 ish. But I wasn't really watching them like during this time period, all the way up until like 2011, 2012. Like, I'm really kind of only watching WWE, and then I was watching TNA, which at the time was super annoying because they were doing the whole Hogan Bischoff era and kind of killing, because TNA was kind of like the first like smark company I liked, because it had, you know, focus on wrestling that was different than WWE. But then of course kind of things kind of fell apart from a creative perspective in TNA. But like, I wasn't having that other outlet, so like the stagnation of the Cena character and Cena in all these matches was very different than I think someone like you, who is much more aware of the wider wrestling world, and the frustration was more on my end, as opposed to if I had been watching other wrestling at the time. If it was like now, I'd be like, yeah, that's what WWE is doing, you know, this other stuff. It's not like the only thing that I could ever possibly watch. But that's what it was like for me, and probably a lot of the fans that expressed the same kind of frustrations. Just like fans would, you know, complain during, you know, the 2010s about WWE and, oh, it's so bad, so bad. I'm like, well, there's all this other, you know, why don't you watch New Japan? Why don't you watch the Indies? But, you know, as a kid, I wasn't aware of that yet.
Yeah. Totally makes sense. Now, I don't want to sell that era of WWE as like my favorite. I mean, I didn't.
I'm not trying to do that either.
Yeah.
You sound like, by the time a lot of us, and by us, I mean people my age, were kind of getting into the early smarkdom and realizing that Cena sucked, or at least we thought Cena sucked, because I don't really think Cena sucks. You had kind of already had the experience of at least keeping WWE at arm's length to a degree, which
correct,
because my was not doing.
That's right. My relationship with WWE began to fracture with the Attitude Era, because I'm one of those people who thought the Attitude Era sucked. And then, you know, ever since that point in time, which now we're going back over 25 years, my relationship with that company was slowly separating to the point where, you know, now I just think it sucks. It's trash. I doubt I'll ever be emotionally invested in WWE wrestling again.
Yeah,
but that long Cena era is where the wedge really started to get wide. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. The Attitude Era lost me. The SmackDown 6 era that came after that kind of brought me back to some extent. And then everything that came after, which was predominantly the Cena stuff, the wedge got wide. And then once Roman came around and anything since the pandemic, it's just like, all right, I'm out. This is not what I want in pro wrestling. And it's never going to be what I want in pro wrestling again. They don't want this to be for me. They're not trying. They're not even attempting to woo me as a fan anymore. And now I'm just completely disconnected from it. But the Cena era was where the wedge got the widest, I would say, and where we reached the point of no return, I would say.
Yeah. And I think because we've also, you know, the Roman Reigns as the top guy era has lasted for so long, it might skewer the perspective a little bit, but the Cena era lasted forever.
Yeah. Long
from
time.
From a perspective, you know, we're talking from 2005 when he first wins the world title to really like 2015.
Right. 10 years, a solid 10 years for sure.
And that is super long when you compare it to like the Attitude Era or like even like the Bret Hart, Shawn era. Like there was there was so much TV time to fill each week with Raw and SmackDown. And it just became so redundant in the, especially right around, I would say like 2009, 2010, the company was in desperate need of new stars, and they needed Cena as his presence to make those guys, and he was really bad at it. That's something where I think Cena's like in-ring work is kind of unfairly maligned a lot of times, and something I think is not maligned enough is how bad he was at like putting other people over and selling their characters. Because he just ate a bunch of these guys up, whether it was the Nexus, whether it was Sheamus when they first started pushing him, whether it was the Miz, all of these guys, with the exception of CM Punk and maybe like Edge. And Edge is more of a contemporary of Cena's.
And I'll give you one other really good one too when you're done with your point.
Yeah, he just, they needed to push some new guys and they just wasn't there. So by the time you get to the 2010s and you're looking at like, oh, we need a big match for WrestleMania, WWE is of course relying on The Undertaker or Triple H and Brock Lesnar coming back and all of this extra outsider stuff, because in a lot of cases they needed to make new big stars when Cena was kind of at his peak and needed to be used to make those new stars. Cena was really bad at it.
Yeah. When I think about Cena's work, I think he did get better over time and he did get more interesting in the ring with age. And I think that you mentioned Punk. There's three opponents that popped into my head when I was thinking about, as you were talking, who were my favorite John Cena opponents? And one of them is Punk. The other is Brock Lesnar. I think he really got out of his comfort zone with Lesnar. And the other is Kevin Owens.
Yep.
The super indie Cena era where he really got completely out of his comfort zone in an effort to help Kevin Owens get over, because he understood that those are the kinds of matches that Kevin Owens was going to need to get over with that audience. And he wanted to work Owens to work a style that was comfortable to him versus being thrown in a side headlock for 7 minutes and five moves of doom and all that. So Cena, to me, that's kind of the era, the however many years that would cover, I guess 2012 through 2015-ish or whatever, when he wrestled those three guys, where it's like, oh, okay, this is the first time in John Cena's career where I'm really digging his wrestling. And while I might not think he's like a top 10 wrestler in the world, he's one of the most interesting wrestlers in the world, because he's willing to be flexible now and work the stuff. I mean, he let Brock Lesnar beat the shit out of him, and he worked Kevin Owens' preferred and comfortable style. And he did really interesting and cool stuff with CM Punk. And Cena wrestled everybody over that decade. Any top guy eventually crossed paths with Cena. And I know he had some good matches with people like Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles, Umaga, of course, who I brought up before. But those are the three to me that instantly pop into my head. But then you, on the other side of the coin, you know, they put him in this endless rivalry with Randy Orton, which fucking sucked. And
what's your favorite Randy Orton versus John Cena match?
I mean, if you gave me time to properly research, I might be able to come up with one or two that weren't right, awful about
theoretically that. One should jump pop into your head, even if you didn't like, even if the feud, even if the, a lot of the matches weren't good, you would think that at least one would be like obviously the best because they wrestled so many matches, and the fact that there isn't one just tells you how dire that thing was,
right? The fact I'd have to research it, like I just said, to come up with one. Didn't they have one gimmick one that was pretty decent? But again, it's like
one gimmick one, I think, like a lot of them
one gimmick good. One that was decent, I mean, because they did a lot of gimmick matches, but
the only one that I can really actually think about as like a real match, and I don't even remember if it was good, as they had an I Quit match at WWE Breaking Point in like,
I believe that may have been the one I'm thinking about, which is funny that we came up with the same
that
one,
match might be bad too, like I have no idea, like I just remember it, like the other ones they were the staples of B pay-per-views, really.
I mean, and they just went back to it for years and years and years, and those guys just didn't have any chemistry. And their styles weren't conducive to having good matches together. But
it would require Randy Orton to work hard too. So
well, and now when Cena comes back, they're going to retcon that as a legendary rivalry in the company. And it's funny because they never had good matches together, and also it never drew.
It never drew. If you go back, but they always talk about it. Like
right, I guess retcon in the sense that we know the jig is up on that. Like,
yeah, there'll be WWE fans, and I'm sure they'll be talking about it on Uncrowned, about what a legendary feud this was.
Right. Like the newer fans aren't going to know any better because it's always been presented as a legendary feud. But like, if you were around during that time, you know that it fucking sucked, and it became a meme that they kept going back to it. And what the super deep hardcore fan understands is that it never really drew money either. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it was just a money drawing rivalry that the Smarks had to put up with because it was also,
it's not like the Hogan Andre rivalry.
Yeah, it wasn't drawing money either. And I think another poor opponent of his, I never really got into anything he ever did with like Seth Rollins. So I know he had a couple matches with Rollins that people probably liked a lot better than I did. I never thought they had particularly great chemistry together. For me, as he got more flexible as a worker, the three again that stand out to me are Punk, Owens, and Lesnar. Those matches I can go back and actually have an active desire to even go back and watch.
Yeah. The first Lesnar match, like Lesnar's first match back.
Yeah.
In WWF. I think that's from, I don't know, Extreme Rules maybe. It was after WrestleMania. That's like a classic WWE match.
It's an all-time great WWE match.
Yeah. Let me like Cena, I guess it doesn't really exist anymore, but at the time the reputation was Cena was a terrible wrestler. Which was part of like the whole Smark war against Cena, in fact, the WWE in a lot of ways, which was like Cena is a representation of a guy with catchphrases and strong booking, and that's why he's a star. And as an actual wrestler, he's bad. Now that we're removed from, you know, the trenches of that battle, where do you think Cena stands in terms of being like an in-ring bell-to-bell wrestler? Would you consider him a bad wrestler? Like if you were, I'm assuming you probably weren't a voter in the Hall of Fame when Cena was voted in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, but let's suppose that he's not in yet and he's coming up on the ballot for the first time. How would you assess like his in-ring output overall? Would you see it as a negative?
No.
I feel like I'm the same way. Like if you look at the scope of like guys who were big drawing card wrestlers, like I don't think Cena stands out as a particularly bad wrestler. He's not a particularly good one either, but he's definitely not to me like a bad wrestler.
I think that I never thought of John Cena as a bad wrestler. Now, I thought of him as a green, inexperienced wrestler when he first came up. And then I obviously thought of him as a formulaic wrestler for a long time during the meat of his career. Again, I think there's a lot of parallels with Hogan. I never thought of Hogan as a bad wrestler. Hogan found a formula at the peak of Hulkamania that worked and made crowds lose their fucking minds, and he stuck with it. And you know, while I don't think a lot of those matches are classic or anything, and even in real time, I was, even as like a kid, I was never like a Hogan guy. And I always, and I never really thought a lot of his matches or feuds. It just wasn't my style. I was prime and ready to become, you know, a hardcore dorky smark even when I was a kid. But I never thought of him as a bad pro wrestler. And I never thought of Cena as a bad pro wrestler. And then again, as I said, later in his career, I thought he was an actively good pro wrestler with a lot of flaws, because his execution was never like flawless. And he'd have a couple moments in all of his matches where it would look a little sloppy and not super tight. And I don't think, but his charisma was able to always carry him through that. But yeah, I never thought of John Cena like a lot of other people did, as some terrible pro wrestler. I think that's a bunch of nonsense. Was he below average for a large portion of his career? Yes. But I don't think it crossed over into, oh my God, he sucks, he's terrible.
Yeah, he's an all-time calling moves loudly in the ring guy.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
He definitely, for a guy that allegedly is not a good wrestler, he has, I think, a lot of memorably very good matches. Now, granted, he had a million opportunities to have really good matches because he wrestled basically every big American star of the last 15 years and in main event, in got main events and gimmick matches and all this kind of stuff that could make a match good. But he has a lot of like instant classic matches. Even like you mentioned the Brock Lesnar one. We could talk about the Kevin Owens matches were really good. The CM Punk Money in the Bank match is one of the, you know, probably one of the five biggest most match, yeah. Yeah, like in terms of like if you were to like what is the best match in WWE history, would probably do quite well on a poll. Like
how about SummerSlam against Daniel Bryan? That instantly comes to mind as a
yes, the one where he put Danielson over.
Yeah,
and clean in the middle of the ring.
Yeah, so there's no doubt about it. He has the Umaga last man standing match, right?
Yeah, that's like an older match in terms of like Cena really wasn't there yet as a complete wrestler, like as he would be like in the 2010s during like the indie Cena run.
Yeah.
But that's a match that I know a lot of people constantly to this day bring up as like one of their all-time favorite matches.
Yeah, and definitely one of the most famous matches of that specific era of the company.
Yeah, and so who would you say is a better in-ring wrestler, Triple H or John Cena?
Well, there's a couple different ways to approach it. I think that if I had to watch one guy or the other, the old Desert Island comp tape, you get one tape, you can bring it to John Cena tape or the Triple H tape. I don't even think it's close. I'm taking the John Cena tape. I don't even think I have to think about it. I think that Cena was more flexible as a worker for all the reasons we laid out previously. Triple H was largely going to have his match against anybody he worked with. And he was far more rigid in his approach and his philosophical approach to what he wanted to do in a match. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that's being filtered down to what we're seeing in the company now in that I don't know necessarily if a lot of the people on their roster wrestle like Triple H did, but his philosophies have certainly seeped in through osmosis in terms of, you know, what style they want out of people. Very
interesting.
Deliberate.
I haven't thought about that before, but like, yeah, you're talking about like a 30-minute main event match with really slow pacing. One wrestler is in control for a super long period of time.
That's right. And very deliberate and obvious storytelling, right? Nothing subtle about it. Like, so I thought this was going to be a difficult point to articulate, but I think you're picking up what I'm trying to lay down here in terms of that. So, yeah, I prefer Cena to Triple H, I think, by a pretty sizable margin. But I think that, unfortunately, Triple H's philosophies, because he's the one in charge, are the ones that are going to endure versus Triple H telling people now, hey, go out there and do what's going to get Jacob Fatu over best. I don't feel like, I think it's more, no, we're going to stick to this slow, deliberate style of storytelling, and no matter who's in the ring, and you're going to make what you do fit to that versus we're going to allow you to look best by making it fit to your skill set.
Yeah, I think Triple H as a technical performer is probably better than John Cena.
Yeah, technically he's a better worker in quotes.
Yeah,
because
his stuff wasn't as better. Yeah, his stuff wasn't as sloppy. He was a pretty good bump taker, especially for a guy his size. But Cena had a has a lot higher of a ceiling.
And when did Triple H ever get out of his comfort zone other than bloody brawls?
Yeah, like
because he can do that. I mean, he'll walk and brawl with you. He'll do that. He's willing to bleed and all those things.
Yeah, but it's not an I don't think it wasn't like necessarily like a laziness thing like it is sometimes with Randy Orton, but I agree that Triple H, you know, wanted. I think the Scott Steiner match is like super famous for the particular point you're talking about, the Royal Rumble match against Scott Steiner, yeah. Which is like they're bringing in Scott Steiner. They really needed him to be taken seriously, and they go out there and have like a 32-minute match where yeah. it's Scott Steiner. Like it shouldn't be that hard to have a good match with this guy, but because
perfect example, Cena would have done what it took for the other guy, and Triple H was less flexible in that way. That's exactly the points I've been making. And he's just far more rigid in what he believes. And here's the bottom line.
I was going to say, compare the Brock Lesnar matches with Cena versus the Brock Lesnar matches with Triple H.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, Triple H really worked his style. And then the only time he drift out of it is to do some walk and brawls and bleed a little. Cena, we've seen him do literally everything with a wide variety of opponents. The bottom line is John Cena is just a much more fun wrestler than Triple H. Triple H, it's almost like you'd have to prepare yourself. Okay, this is going to be heavy. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, it's a Triple H match. I'm in for something heavy, right? Cena, I never gave me that feeling. Like, Cena, I was either in for a cartoon Five Moves of Doom ride, or I was in for he's going to do something interesting to make his opponent look good. Cena's just more fun than Triple H.
Yes. Well, like Triple H is like, I'm going to like, it's like watching a director where all his work is like 2.5 hours of like really methodically paced. And maybe sometimes it really comes together and sometimes it's also awful, but it's like that every time, as opposed to Cena is a much more versatile, like, ooh, I don't know what I'm going to get. Maybe this is like a 90-minute crazy slapstick comedy. And maybe it's something different. Like there's just a lot more versatility there as opposed to.
For sure.
I don't know why I picked Triple H as an example. I just thought like, I feel like Triple H is, in terms of like a lot of smark circles, although not like the hardcore smarks, like I think Triple H would be viewed as a good wrestler. We can talk about the build for WrestleMania 22 if you want, but Triple H would be viewed by some fans as a good wrestler and Cena as a bad wrestler.
Well, I don't participate in like those greatest wrestler ever polls or anything like that, because my brain just doesn't work that way. And I just wouldn't be able to, it would drive.
I don't really like the ranking and comparison of guys like that. Like I don't want to have to compare Will Ospreay to Toshiaki Kawada.
Yeah, it's too hard for me, and I would constantly change my mind too much. But I can comfortably say that if I were to plot out what I thought were the 100 greatest wrestlers of all time, I would easily, if they were going to both make the list, let's say, I'd have Cena ahead of Triple H comfortably, easily, and there wouldn't be much debate in my mind.
Yeah, no, I agree. With Cena coming, this is his last year, of course. I have found the last few years of Cena, when he's popped up and done these WWE matches, kind of really wasteful. Part of that is the idea is like, okay, we've got this older star, let's bring him in and let's use him to put over some younger guys that we want to push. But the problem is Cena's terrible at putting those guys over. And the other guys they've chosen, like people like Austin Theory, aren't very good. And so I'm really kind of intrigued. This is his last year. I don't know how many matches he's actually going to wrestle, what they actually do with him, because they could use him to put over Bron Breakker or Trick Williams or some of these other young guys that they maybe want to push as top stars. But it would seem to be like a way better use of Cena to do like Cena versus Cody Rhodes or Cena versus CM Punk again, Cena versus Roman again, like all this kind of stuff that you could get a lot more drawing out of him as opposed to using him as a guy that can put people over, especially when you're at a position where I don't feel like you really need John Cena to do that.
Yeah. He
hasn't meant like anything to WWE when he's come back, like in terms of just being interesting. It's been very boring last few years.
I think that a lot of people would disagree with this, but I wouldn't waste any time with him putting people over in the traditional sense either. I would just put him in there with other big stars. I would put him in there with the other big stars that they have right now, some that where you can touch on history, like maybe something with Punk would be cool. and also the people that he's never had a chance to really interact with, like Cody, you know, and I would do that as opposed to, you know, let's get him in there with, like you're saying, like a Bron Breakker or something. I don't have any interest in that. And I don't even really think they need that. Those guys are going to get over just fine with them. That's a well-oiled machine right now. And they have buy-in from their fan base, that precious buy-in that you like to achieve that AEW had at one point. And now WWE has it, where their fans are very willing to buy whatever the company sells them. So they don't even need John Cena to help get any of these guys over. And look, they've tried it. And like you said, he didn't even seem interested in getting Austin Theory over. I don't think he bought it or believed in it. And then they also burned it off with the Bray Wyatt thing, which was like the mini movie and not really a match. And that was a waste of everybody's time. I never thought about this before, but I think you make an interesting point. And maybe John Cena isn't the best guy for that role. He just hasn't really ever excelled at it, at getting people over.
For starters, he is not like very giving in terms of like his character is basically invulnerable.
He'll lose, though.
He'll lose, but his character, like, when we're talking about, like, his, like, when, especially when he's like, cutting promos and stuff like that, like, even if he loses, his character just kind of hits a reset button. Like, they did that, it was a very bad finish, but they did this whole thing where Cena lost, I don't forget if it was a Hell in a Cell or a cage match, it was when he was feuding with Bray Wyatt before. And remember this, the hologram, the singing child finish?
Yeah.
Awful. So, like, ridiculous finish to match, and, like, the next week, like Cena's like totally like normal. Like he didn't just lose a match because he's tossing a child. Like the idea was in the match, at least the reason Cena lost was that he was so surprised and spooked by what Bray Wyatt had done from a mental game perspective that he had been compromised and he had lost a wrestling match. And then like the next week, it's like, oh, it's the same Cena character. So his character was never really that vulnerable. And when it came to cutting promos and like, oh, we're going to bring this guy out and we're going to go face to face. Like Cena was not a giving guy in that sense. When he was in there with a guy like a CM Punk or Chris Jericho, a guy that could, I think on his feet and be and was as comfortable on the microphone as Cena was and was able to work a crowd the way Cena was, it worked fine. But when he was in the ring with sharing a feud and doing promos with anybody that wasn't close to his level, he just destroyed them. And you saw that in the Austin Theory feud. Like, he's just like, oh, I'm just going to say like, oh, we know they pump in booze for you because you can't get any real heat. Like just like totally just taking a giant shit on this guy that he's then supposed to put over in a way that never really actually meant anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
He carried the shit out of Roman in their feud. Remember when he was like, they had to bring me back because you can't do your job. Yeah. And they're like, he lost to Roman, but that didn't help Roman at all at the time.
Yeah. It's interesting because he is willing to lose. He's not a guy that's like historically, we've seen him lay on his back and lose to plenty of people, but that there's an art to putting people over, and you also have to want to do it. And maybe he's a slicker politician than we think, and he just doesn't want to put these people over. That could very much be it. In pro wrestling, you really have to buy into anything that you're doing. For the audience sees through when something is inauthentic in wrestling. So if you're quote unquote putting a guy over, it doesn't work because the audience is going to see through that. And interesting, you know, for a guy you can't see, Jesse Collins, maybe the audience sees through his weak attempts to put people over. Look, I'm tired and it's early. I'm sorry. That was awful. But I, you know, maybe.
Well, I think the audience also like with a particular like Austin Theory, like there's also, you just picked a bad guy for him to try to put over. Like a guy that didn't have the charisma or talent to really warrant a main event push in WWE.
And seen as a company guy, and he went along with doing it, but he didn't really want to do it, so he didn't do it.
And he didn't believe in it. So, like, you can tell when a guy...
No one remembers or cares that Theory beat him.
No, what's that done for Theory's career? He beat John Cena in the opening match of WrestleMania? Wow, that should have changed his career. But it really did nothing for him. But that's more on... You can say the company didn't follow up adequately, but I think from people that like at least watch and evaluate wrestling, unless you're Gabe Sapolsky, like Theory was just never a guy that really was going to be able to hang at the highest level.
You know, I had times during Theory's career where I believed them. There were okay. It's so funny with him because I know this isn't a Theory podcast, but there were times in Evolve where I was like, "What the fuck is Gabe thinking?" There were other times in Evolve where I was like, "Okay, I get it now." And there was even a brief period in WWE where I was like, this guy's going to make it. There was a period when he was in NXT where I was like, oh yeah, I get it again. But it just, it was fleeting. And there's something about him to where he can never hold on to that and ever gain momentum. And he might just be one of those guys that ultimately just doesn't have it. But I do see where others think that he does. It's hard to like.
Yeah, I mean, when he came into Evolve, right, he's so young. Like, he was, I think, still like probably 19 teenager.
Or something. Yeah. Like that 20, yeah.
When he came into Evolve, and, you know, he had a really good look for the indies, especially as a young kid. And he was athletic, and he looked like he worked hard in the ring. I saw him, like, a year apart. Like, I think he wrestled, like, I want to say he wrestled like Josh Briggs or something on an Evolve show, and it was kind of like pedestrian. And then he came back a year later and wrestled Matt Riddle in like a title match, and it was way better. And I was like, all right, this guy's clearly, you know, he was still only like 20 or 21. So like, okay, this guy's clearly got potential, and everyone kind of assumed he was destined for WWE because he had muscles and he was in Evolve. But once he got to the main roster, I just think like, okay, does this guy have top guy charisma? No. Is he one of the best 20 workers in the world, which is what you would need to do to overcome not having top guy charisma? No. And like, he had a good body, but he wasn't like Dave Bautista. Like, he wasn't like a guy with just like a jaw dropping look. So all that just factored against him, but it's a guy like at the time. And I think this is one of the issues with WWE. If they wanted to use and leverage Cena in that role, is that they don't have a lot of promising young talent that I would like think would benefit from beating John Cena. And another part of it is that like John Cena is still a big star, but he's not really like the measuring stick in WWE because he's not around that much. Like, if they really want to go all the way with Braun Breaker, they should have him beat Cody or Roman Reigns. They shouldn't really have him beat John Cena. That won't really move him up that much because John Cena is kind of not around anymore. He's a like semi-retired legend.
He will be very much into working with the other big stars, and he'll have his heart and his mind in it, and the fans are going to buy it. And I think all of those matches are going to come across great, at least in the builds. And then, you know, we'll see what he has left physically. Cause like you're saying, he's not a guy who wrestles a lot, and when you lose it, it goes fast. But, you know, I think between his charisma and the charisma of the people he'll be working with, they can get around that.
Yes. Like, know, him and Punk and him and Cody, I think would be those matches.
Like, you really think he's going to go out there with Cody and have a fucking dud? They're going to have a crowd pleasing match.
I used to say it, but it's like WWE now. Like, they could come up with some really bad idea for why it would be a dud. Like,
yeah,
we saw that with Punk. Like, oh, Punk and Drew McIntyre, they're not going to go have a dud. Like, well, what if they had a match about a bracelet instead?
But you know what? Yeah. That's winning feud of the year in every fucking poll. And their fans loved it. You know, it's like, it's just curmudgeons like us that are like, I don't want to watch people fight over a charm bracelet. But, you know,
well, I won feud of the year because a WWE thing has to win those awards. And what would be the alternative?
I completely agree. But even judged against other things that happened in that company, people feel like their fans feel like that feud was above everything else that happened this year in wrestling. And I get it. It's just, that's that disconnect that people like you and me have with what they present.
So,
they feel like they need the charm bracelet to give it a story, right? And we feel like we don't need the fucking charm bracelet. We just need them to hate each other. But it's just, that's the disconnect right there. That feud is the perfect encapsulation of the disconnect.
So I was explaining this to my dad the other day. And my dad, like, has been to a couple wrestling shows with me and like understands pro wrestling to a degree. He's not a fan or anything like that, right, but he at least from being my dad and coming to shows with me and stuff like that and hearing me talk about it has a, you know, a somewhat basic understanding of like smarky wrestling fandom. Right.
Right. Right.
And we were watching the Penn State Boise State game. Right. And as the game starts, the pregame and then a kickoff, you know, the announcers are talking about Ashton Jeanty, like, oh, like this guy is an amazing running back. Let's see if Penn State can stop him. Look at his stats. Look at this. And they mention it all the time about how great this running back is for Boise State. And my dad was like, why are they keep mentioning this all the time? Like, we've heard him the first time. We know their running back is good. We don't need it to be said every 5 seconds on the broadcast. Like, do they have a directive from like the TV director who's saying you got to mention it all the time? And I said, well, the idea is like, if you're watching Boise State for the first time, which most of the people watching this game probably are, you know, they just got to hammer that home because they're catering towards the absolute lowest common denominator. And I was saying, and I led into telling me that about like, this is what a lot of media is like wrestling is like this now too, like WWE, like they can't have a match where it's like, say like these two guys used to be friends and one of them turned on each other and now they're having a match with like extra intensity and extra speed because that's the story. They need to stop and say, you used to be my friend and now you're not. I'm going to end you, like in the middle of the match. My dad's like, that's the dumbest thing. That subverts the entire art. I'm like, I know, but that's what our culture is like now.
Yeah. I mean, these are what turns into the unhinged rants that I go on my audio all the time. I don't need all of that, but you know, their audience, not only, I don't even think their audience needs it. Their audience just likes it. And that's the part that I struggle to understand. Their audience is devoted and locked in and understands the stories, but they still like being beat over the head with said stories.
Yeah, I mean, if you like the story, then I feel like you would feel okay being reminded about it a lot of the time. And then also, that's coming from like, well, WWE does it and I like WWE, so therefore I'm going to say I like it.
You just look at Punk and Drew. If you must use a charm bracelet as a catalyst for hatred, okay. But that they always, the charm bracelet had to be the central focus of every match that they then had. You see what I mean? That's the over the top nature of pounding you over the head with their stories that annoys us and drives us away. Cause we're like, we heard you. He's mad about the charm bracelet, but their audience wants that for some reason. They want to be constantly be reminded of the charm bracelet, which, you know, not literally, you could expand that to all their other feuds too.
They're not very smart people. That's what we're getting into here. They're just not that smart and they don't have
statistically poor and dumb. I mean, I guess, but that's become the meme, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. That's why it's just, I don't understand it and it won't be for me. That annoys you and me, but their audience wants that subtlety hammer and wants everything over explained all the time. And I just don't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, we saw it with like AEW, like how many times do we have to hear about AEW need more video packages to explain things to everyone?
Yeah.
Right. That's because they weren't getting the same kind of production they were getting out of WWE that they were familiar with. And like, what the hell is this?
Even the more basic point of a lot of these WWE fans are convinced that AEW doesn't tell stories and it's nothing but dream matches.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's not based on evidence. It's based on people hearing other people say that.
In some cases, yes. But in some cases, absolutely. I completely agree. Yeah. It's a lot of people just talking shit that don't even watch. But it's also people who have attempted to watch where the storytelling isn't as in your face as it's done in any other place. So they, to them, it isn't storytelling. Right?
You know who always told his stories clear and direct? John Cena. Remember when he had that match against Rusev? That was America versus Russia.
Doesn't get remember more.
Remember the flag match?
Wrestling than that.
That was like when you were, that was like in the middle of like that indie Cena run too, where he was like wrestling a lot of these new guys. And then he went out, he just had a very bad feud with Rusev where they had an extremely methodical, slow match about raising one's flag up a set of metal stairs that were on the entrance ramp. And
I think Rusev, because you brought him up, I've been thinking about Rusev a lot. You're probably wondering, Joe, why have you been thinking about Rusev, right? I think he's one of the most one-dimensional wrestlers in modern wrestling history. That guy is fucking great at like 6-minute sprints, and he's terrible at everything else. I mean, he had that one little era there in WWE where he was having these short, explosive matches against like Big E on pay-per-view. I don't know if you remember this era where they were getting him over. And then when in AEW, same thing, when he had, you know, the TV title, whichever channel the men's TV title is, I think it's TNT. You know, same thing, short explosive matches. The guy looks phenomenal. You're like, oh my God, this guy should be a top star. But anything out of that little mini comfort zone, like the fucking flag match against Cena, it just completely falls apart.
Yeah. I mean, if I were to summarize his career at this point, it's almost worth summarizing because I don't know how much of his career we're going to see of him in the future. He's an extremely talented guy that for a variety of reasons has rarely been able to harness all of that talent into meaningful work.
I also don't think he takes it all that seriously.
Well, that's a major part of the issue, I would say.
Yeah.
And that, like, I think he's very charismatic. He's an unconventional wrestler in the sense of, like, he doesn't really wrestle like a traditional powerhouse, which you would assume looking at his body. Like, he's not a guy that's just doing like a bunch of power slams and military presses and power bombs and stuff like that. He's more of like a brawler. Like, he wrestles like a guy who wants to wrestle at like a fast pace as opposed to like your methodical powerhouse, which is kind of, I don't know if everyone has always understood that. Like you said, those are kind of why the matches he would kind of succeed and fail in. You know, his creative has been up and down throughout his entire wrestling career as well. But with Cena, I think he's probably the most important wrestler of the 21st century. Would you say that's crazy?
The most important wrestler of the 21st century. Yes, so far, yes, yes, yes.
Like, I could say that, like, Hiroshi Tanahashi, you know, really being a catalyst for a huge turnaround in New Japan Pro Wrestling, if you take him out of the equation, is wrestling way more different than if it was John Cena wasn't around.
Well, if you're opening it up to, Mystico would have to be in the conversation.
Yeah, there are guys that I think you could, but I just think Cena is probably, like, obviously, like, you know.
Biggest company, right? So.
Yeah. In The Rock and Austin, like, they're around, but they're kind of more 90s stars that trickled into the 2000s a little bit. I think Cena, now that we're approaching the 25th year of the century, that, like, Cena is the most important wrestler for a variety of reasons. And I think that he's probably going to end up being kind of underrated because I think this boom period coming when he really wasn't around, I think maybe when we look back on it, it's going to change what a lot of people think about him. But if you really do a deep dive into the numbers, the impact that he had on house show tours year after year after year, there are times where he didn't draw, but he was for such a long period of time, the lone difference maker that company had.
Hey, how about this? I mean, even when they've brought him back sporadically during this boom period, they have used him to save house shows at times when Roman wasn't getting the job done. And that's just fact. You can go look at that. MSG, other places where there were sagging ticket sales. And this is Bloodline era Roman. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And they would bring in, they'd ask Cena to come work the shows. And then all of a sudden they'd sell 3,000, 4,000 more tickets. And, you know, he always pops numbers when he's on TV. So even into this era, in front of fans that may not necessarily look, let's do the math. Did a 20-year-old WWE fan grow up with John Cena as a fan?
No.
I mean,
depends when they started watching, but.
Well, if they started when they were 10, Cena was on his way out.
Yeah.
It was the back end of his era. It was 2015, 2016. So it's like, you know, despite that, he's able to come in now and make a difference. And he's going to make a difference, obviously, on the retirement tour. One thing wrestling has really tapped into lately is the whole retirement thing, whether it's Muto, whether it's Sting, and now they're going to do it with Cena. All these promoters pay attention to each other.
Tanahashi also.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. That one coming up. And they're all going to work. I mean, you know, Tanahashi's going to fill that dome next year. I don't have any doubt Tanahashi's going to fill that dome next year for his final match, no matter who it's against. It should be Okada, but we'll see if that's what they do. There might still be bad feelings. Maybe another year will kind of quell those bad feelings. And the thing is, Tanahashi's the president and he's going to do what he wants anyway. So if he wants, whoever he wants, he's going to get, provided the other person wants to do
it. I think Jericho should do a retirement tour, treat it like super, super seriously. And at the end, when he loses, say, I'm never retiring.
I think Jericho should do the super serious retirement tour but in a tongue-in-cheek way where people don't want his retirement tour. That would be fun.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Like,
I'm just, I think it'd probably be like kind of maybe a bad idea, but like, just like imagine the nuclear meltdown heat where like he just did like us. Cause if he announced his retirement tour, like super serious, Tony went along with it and everything like that. Like, yeah. I think people's opinions on him taking up TV time would change pretty quickly. And then like at the end when he's just like, do they do it? Like, just like they did it with Sting. It's like so impactful. They're in Winnipeg. And then he just says, oh, are you kidding me? I'm never retiring. Like, that would be
There's
awesome.
A lot of ways you can go with it. That would be fun.
But yeah, free idea, Chris. Cena never turned heel. Well, he was a heel during the early run of his career, but it looks like he never turned heel.
Well, you're right that he never turned heel. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, he was introduced as a babyface, I believe.
Well, oh, the ruthless aggression thing. Yeah, you're right. So he gets
and then he was, you know, his white rapper gimmick started out as a heel and then became babyface. Yeah, yeah. Has a memorable match against The Undertaker as heel John Cena when he was doing the full-blown Vanilla Ice gimmick. But he never turned heel. It was something that was discussed a trillion times throughout the 21st century. It's, I believe, the most discussed topic in the history of social media is actually John Cena heel turns. Did you ever think he, like, were you like one of those people that really wanted him to turn heel? Like, there's an argument. Like, I know Dave has said basically every time it's like, every time they thought about turning him heel, they just realized he was more valuable as a face and merchandise money and all things like that. I still think they lost a lot of potential by never doing a massive heel Cena run. I think that was money on the table that's just been left. I don't care how many t-shirts he was selling as a babyface. I think that was a time that was something that was sorely needed to this day. What were your thoughts on him just being like a real career babyface in an era where that basically never happens?
I'm sure there were times where I thought they should have done it. I don't remember specifically. I will say that I think the difference between Cena, oh my God, this guy should go heel, and Roman, oh my God, this guy should go heel, is Roman absolutely needed it. And that bared out and was proven when they did it, right? Because that's the catalyst for Roman finally getting over the top and becoming a legitimate star in pro wrestling, a real money drawing star, where Cena already was. So I could see why the company always thought about it and decided not to, because they're like, well, we don't need to do this. It's not necessary. Things are going well. They may not have various times thought they had the correct baby face to oppose him. I'm sure I thought about it. I'm sure I pushed for it at different times, but it was never something where I can remember thinking that the company was dropping some massive ball because they weren't doing it.
Yeah. I mean, like as a fan at the time, as I said earlier, I just felt like the company had gotten so stagnant, especially the Cena character, and a heel turn was desperately needed. I remember I wanted him to turn heel after the second Rock match at WrestleMania. I wanted him to like hit the Rock with the title belts and like just go super hard heel over the Rock, because I thought that would launch like a whole new avenue for him and for WWE and make things a lot more interesting. But he was just always there as the perpetual babyface. And there was, you know, I think he is the best like company person that the company has ever seriously pushed as the top guy in terms of his willingness to do all the front public facing stuff, talk shows, doing, obviously he's very well known for his Make-A-Wish stuff. He never, unless he's talking about the state of Taiwan, he never really says anything too divisive publicly. I think he's been an excellent ambassador for wrestling and the WWE product, and he's been, you know, there are guys who were bigger baby faces and more successful faces of the company for WWE, but I don't think they've ever had a better face of the company from that perspective.
Yeah, Hogan was always out for himself ultimately. Roman, when he disappears from TV, just disappears wholesale. He just drops off the planet.
Roman's, I was talking about this with Brandon, like Thurston, like when we talk about like who replaced Cena, like really Cody is the Cena replacement.
I agree. Yeah, like, that was the next point I was going to make. I think that Cody is the closest to what you're describing with Cena.
Like Roman's a babyface now, so you could say Roman's the biggest babyface in the company, but he's really not a functional top babyface.
Right.
because of his schedule.
Heart and soul of the fans and all of that. That's not what Roman is.
Yeah, and Cody wants to do all the talk shows and stuff like that too. He obviously did that a lot when he was in AEW and slid right into the role in WWE. But I think Cena, from a presentation perspective, was an excellent person at doing all of that stuff that they wanted to do.
I don't think Roman connects with the fans on a human level. He's 100% character. He's just a cat. He's like, you know what I mean by that? Like,
yeah,
I think that Cena eventually had a emotional, like he connected with the fans on an emotional. I think Cody has that or desperately tries to have that. And I think he does have that. Whereas Roman is so just out there playing a role in a fucking action show. Like he's not a real human when he's on the screen and has come across as a real human.
At this point with his babyface turn, which is tied into the Bloodline character, and he's a babyface because the Bloodline guys turned on him and the Solo Sikoa division of the group turned on him. He's a babyface from circumstance. He's not actually a babyface because the fans like were demanding him to be babyface, like cheering, and there's nothing like he could have kept being heel Roman Reigns.
I don't think there's any functional difference between what he is now. It's just the story. He's the good guy now, but he's the same guy. I mean, okay, with a little less of the insecurity that was the basis of the heel gimmick.
Kind of. And then it kind of stopped being the basis of the heel gimmick.
Right. But now it's, but otherwise, have you ever felt like you were getting, now look, they're all workers to a degree. I mean, we understand that at a base level. I shouldn't have to explain that. But did you ever feel like you were getting the real Joe Anoa'i or whatever on screen versus Cena and Cody? They have achieved that to where it felt like they were giving you themselves. Like their on-screen personas are an extension of who they are. And I think that's why they have a stronger crowd connection than Roman, where people are just more wrapped up in the story than the person.
Yeah. I would say like when Roman was a babyface, there were times like, pre-Bloodline where they tried to get that character on screen. You could argue how successful that actually was.
It didn't work. I mean, there's no argument.
The funny thing is like in real life, like I find like Cena is like kind of like a charismaless weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so it's not necessarily like Cena is being his real authentic self as much as it is like Cena is able to present a character who feels like a real authentic person.
I don't have any doubt Roman would be a cooler hang in real life than Cena would be. I mean, Cena like, is a fucking weirdo.
It's always like Cena would
serial killer vibes.
Cena would do these things where he would sometimes pop, not all the time, but I remember noticing it at the time, like he would pop on and do commentary, like because of an angle or something like that. But like, it's the main event. John Cena is going to be on commentary as his, pay-per-view opponent is wrestling someone. And he was like a incredibly terrible, boring commentator, like all time bad, like no charisma. And it was so weird because it's like this guy is super charismatic. He can go out there in front of 14,000 people and cut a promo where people are booing him, but then they're cheering him at the end. Like he's such a natural, telegenic on-screen performer. But on commentary, I don't know if it's because he wasn't scripted or he just like he didn't feel comfortable, or like he was so bad. And I just remember that being that's something I'll always remember about him, is that he was like just weirdly not good at doing commentary. Like they should never use him in that role ever. Because it like exposed him for some reason, but he was like, and I guess I never really watched like Total Divas or Total Bellas or whatever, but people who did watch that show said like John Cena is like a weirdo neat freak. Like he's got all these weird quirks and he's got like OCD about stuff. And I don't know how like normal of a person he is, but as a personality, yes. Like in the ring.
You have to, at the same time, you got to be careful sometimes with reality shows because they
find it. I know.
They turn you into a character. You know what I mean? Like they find them.
Yeah, they turn them, they find a quirk and then make it the most extreme version of that.
Exactly. But yeah, he does come across a bit as a bit of a weirdo. But the point is, Cena and Cody have gotten, I think, their hearts across more on television than Roman ever has. Roman just comes across like a one-dimensional movie character. And honestly, that's what they're going for with that whole thing anyway. So stupid. And yeah, it's obviously the thing that is.
Like, what is his. I guess the answer is it never has to end, but like, what's his character when the Bloodline angle ends?
Here's the best way I can put it too. With Cena and Cody, you could easily see the guy that cuts the 20-minute promo to open up Raw and the guy and the character that's on camera being, we know that they're not, but being the guy that the same guy off camera.
Mm-hmm.
Roman cannot be the guy he is on camera, off camera. He'd be like a not a real person. Like he'd be, you see what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah, some wrestlers are like that, man. They live the gimmick.
Does he walk around in life going to telling his wife to acknowledge him? I mean, it's just preposterous.
He's going to be like Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard, like playing her character in real life. And people are like, why are you still playing this character?
Where you could see John Cena or Cody just stepping out of the ring into their real life and being a reasonable facsimile of what you just saw on screen. Roman is 100% gimmick.
Yeah, like I'm fascinated by like the answer. He doesn't need to be versatile because this Bloodline angle never gets old and people just will love it forever, apparently. But like, although I think that's probably starting to crack. It kind of depends on what The Rock ends up doing this year. But like, in terms of like I can't, like his character is tied into this Bloodline angle and it's like, is it going to wrap up the Bloodline angle? And then who is he going to be? Is he going to be Mob Boss Roman? Like, it just kind of weird. It doesn't really matter because he's also not on TV all the time anyway. So, and that's another thing in terms of like being a babyface. Like Cena was working house shows. He worked, he was the main event or semi-main event on a million billion pay-per-views in a row, you know, for a really long period of time. He was durable as a drawing card, even if for me, he wasn't necessarily like versatile enough to be interesting and hold my attention. But he continued to be a fan and he was, you know, the woman and child fan favorite for multiple generations of children. I mean, I got into him as a child right when he was kind of taking off. But 10 years later, people who were 10 years younger than me watched John Cena when they were 6 or 7 years old and they loved him too. Like he was really consistent at getting over with younger fans of subsequent generations. And kids do change a lot over that time period. You know, kids in 2007 were different than kids in 2013.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it on John Cena. Let's get a quick Rams talk in here. How are you feeling on the as we head into week 18, which is a week that does not matter?
My thoughts are exactly the same as the last time we talked about the Rams on your show. They are a team this year that is capable of beating anyone in the league, as we've seen when they beat the Bills and the Vikings. And they are a team that is capable to losing to anyone in the league. No outcome would ever surprise me with the Rams game, except maybe if they played the Browns or something like that. But, it's a real look. I don't think that they can get through the gauntlet of a playoff. I don't expect them to make a Super Bowl run because they're going to have a game where the offense doesn't score and they're going to get picked off. But do I think they could win a couple games in the playoffs? Sure.
I think the NFC is open. So,
yeah.
I think any of those teams are vulnerable.
No, I agree. I just don't think that the Rams are equipped to win three playoff games. That I don't think can happen. Now look, they've won five games in a row. The Rams have not won an easy game all year.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter who they play.
Can you apologize to America for just the Rams being part of just some absolutely hideous games of football?
You know, they have a lot of this year. They've won in different ways. You know, they won the shootout against the Bills. And they won
they've won a lot of ugly games. Like
they've won a lot of different ways. Like that's what I was getting to. Like they can play with the Bills and outscore them. They can play with the Vikings and outscore them, but then they play a team like the Jets or the 49ers in the rain or that Arizona game where they win it in a very Mike Tomlin Steelers way, where it's like, it's low scoring, it's ugly. And yet I never had the sense in any of them, even as close as they were, that McVay wasn't going to find a way to beat Jeff Ulbrich and the Jets. I feel like he's become such an adaptable coach and his teams can win in a multitude of ways. It's weird. It's like they're an amoeba of a team this year.
Yeah, it's definitely like you look at the roster and you'd be like, all right, high powered offense. We got Stafford. We got good receivers. We finally got like a really good, consistent running back. like, you know, probably putting up 30, 35 points a game and just like, you know, throwing the ball all over the field. But that really hasn't necessarily been the case on a consistent basis. There's been some health issues. There's been some offensive line issues. You know, there hasn't been a ton of games where Nacua and Kupp were both at 100%.
Yeah.
But you would look at them on paper and be like, oh, this is a classic McVay, like high-powered offense team. But it's kind of not. It's, you know, there's a very good – the defense has performed very well at certain tests, which is impressive given the loss of Donald. It's almost like that doesn't get – at least in the national media, it doesn't get brought up. I don't know locally if that's something people still talk about. But, like, they lost, you know, one of the, I don't know, 10 best defensive players of all time who was still playing at a really high level, and it hasn't really impacted their defense.
And outside of the Bills game, and that's Josh Allen, they don't give up points.
Yeah.
You know, they
and they lost Raheem Morris. I mean, they lost their defensive coordinator too.
Yeah. And you know, the Jared versus, you know, and Brandon Fisk have been great. One of them might win defensive rookie of the year. Last year, Kobe Turner was great and should have won defensive rookie of the year. And they have two or three DBs that are rookies who, you know, Cam Kitchens is an interception machine. They've drafted great on the defensive side of the ball. And I think that defense is only going to get better in year two, three, and four of those guys' rookie contracts. The dirty secret about the Rams has always been that when Sean McVay's at his best is when they're a downhill power running team. And everyone thinks of them as this high flying scoring team because in 2017, all those long touchdowns, you know, in McVay's first year, and then Cooper Kupp and Puka Nacua and all these guys.
You get Stafford, who's the master of the 7-step drop and stuff like that. Like,
but that team functions best when they're a downhill. You know, when Todd Gurley was healthy and that zone blocking scheme they were using during that time is when their offense was probably at peak form. And when they get Kyren Williams, he wants to be a downhill running team that then opens up the passing game from there. And you look historically at the McVay era, when they've struggled to run the ball, the team has struggled. When they've run the ball well, the team has had success. But it's nice to see Shanahan miss the playoffs. That's 4 years out of eight for him. And it's nice to see McVay make the playoffs. That's 6 years out of eight for him and the Super Bowl win. And, you know, so I just get annoyed that, you know, you see these stupid lists and they always have Shanahan ahead of McVay. And, you know, Shanahan owned him for a while, but that has changed too. I mean, he swept them this year. And if you look at their one loss record against each other, it's basically the same. That really bothers me.
I think that 49ers situation too is grim.
Oh,
I think we talked about this before, in terms of their window maybe being closed.
Peaked in overtime of that Super Bowl this past year. That was their chance. I think it's all downhill from here. So I do think they're facing and they're paying a lot of guys. They signed a lot of guys. I think it's great. Now, look, next year they're going to play that last place schedule. So they might have one last run in them. You know, they'll have the easy schedule next year. But yeah, I'm just so sick and tired of just this assumption that Shanahan's a better coach than McVay. What are we basing this on exactly? I mean, you know, what are we basing it on?
Shanahan made it to two Super Bowls. Oh, wait.
Yeah, McVay, so did McVay. But he won one. And he won
that's
one.
Right.
You know,
how did that happen?
McVay has one losing season. Shanahan has four.
Yeah, Shanahan's career record is not like I always like the Shanahan Mike McCarthy comparison point because like Shanahan's career record is not that good. And Mike McCarthy's career record is that good, but they have polar opposite. Like,
who's tighter and worse in a big game than Shanahan? And I mean, you know,
Mike McCarthy, maybe. Like, there's been some. Yeah, it's not like this year. You can kind of say like, okay, a lot of guys got hurt, and that maybe there's a roster construction issue and things like that. But there have been some pretty bad exits. Who'd you say is the gun to your head right now?
You know what though? A lot. McVay had a lot of guys hurt too, and he started 1-4. And then
every team has a lot of guys hurt too.
And McVay legitimately did. He didn't have either of his wide receivers in 3/5 of his line. He started 1-4, and then the media was trading all of his players again.
Yeah.
You know, the Rams do really well for a team that trades Matt Stafford every year. It's incredible how
he also might retire.
Well, he might. His now that part's legitimate because his contract is structured as a year-to-year deal where either side can get out on a year-to-year basis with little damage to the cap. So that's going to be up to Stafford. I think he wants to be a TV guy, and I think he wants to transition to that at some point. And I think he's going to stay and live in LA and all that. But it's just amazing how McVay does it when they trade Matt Stafford and Cooper Kupp every year. It's crazy.
Right. Rams grievance corner has ended. Who do you have as the Super Bowl matchup right now?
I think the Bills are going to win the Super Bowl. if you're asking me today. I think I think that it just feels like Josh Allen this year feels undeniable to me, and I think he should be the MVP.
I think he should be an MVP too. And I'm starting
to get clearly the best player in the league.
I'm starting to get a little bit annoyed at, well, Lamar Jackson has better stats. We don't want just the narrative to take over. Like, we're not talking about baseball here. Right?
Yeah.
We're not talking about who had a higher WAR and a higher WRC plus. We're talking about quarterbacks in the NFL. It's a little bit different. We can't just look at some stats and say, well, more touchdowns, fewer interceptions, more yards, higher completion percentage, ex facto, he's the MVP. I think a lot more goes into that. I think the Chiefs are going to win the Super Bowl. I will believe that when they are officially eliminated from winning the Super Bowl.
You know, I will say this though. I think if I don't know when this podcast is going up, because we're
probably early next week.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a dumb thing to say, but I think if the Bengals do get their inside straight and make the playoffs, I think I'd vote Burrow for MVP. I think that would change my mind. Cause he's played out of his mind and
he, on that, the game against Broncos on Thursday, he won the game 3 times.
Yes.
Like, he brought him down the field, scored a touchdown, take the lead with like a minute and a half left. Defense immediately surrenders and gives up a miracle play to the Broncos to go to overtime. He then brings them down to like the 5-yard line. The backup kicker shanks it.
Yeah.
Then he has to go overtime and bring them down the field again. So
doesn't he hold the record for 30-point games that resulted in losses in a single season for an offense? And the other thing is, he plays against the opponent. He plays against his defense. He plays against his kicking game, and he plays against his dope of a head coach. That guy stinks.
Yeah. That would be, if they miss the playoffs, I could see Taylor going, and that has to be the most
desirable,
intriguing job. I don't know who would be the person that would want
but
that.
Only because of Burrow, because the owner stinks, and you know, it's, you know, but yeah, it's, and that's even more of an, I mean, it's a one man franchise at this point.
I would be worried about paying T. Higgins. I do not like paying a ton of money for a quarterback, which you have to do, especially if it's a player like Burrow, and then a ton of money for 2 wide receivers. I think that's ridiculous.
I agree.
Bad team building strategy.
I agree. I think people panicked when the Bills let Stephon Diggs go. It hasn't mattered at all.
Well, I thought the Chiefs getting rid of Tyreek Hill, I thought was
that didn't matter.
A really bold move. But
the great quarterback is gonna score a point.
And you look at this Bengals team, and it's like, I've heard like smart people, like smart football writers that I like and stuff, be like, well, how could you break up this Burrow, Higgins, and Chase trio? And it's like, the team's 7-8 or whatever. Like, it's not like
they're
undefeated. Like, they have, and the reason they're like that is because they have a ton of flaws elsewhere. So it's like, you're going to pay to keep your passing attack super powerful, but that is only getting you to 500, and kind of like a miracle 500 when you talk about that Cowboys win. And stuff like that. So to me, I would be looking at that. I'd be like, you know, T. Higgins is a good player. He's going to get a lot of money because the wide receiver market is not great this year for free agents. I'm sure the Patriots will want to make a very sturdy offer for him. But like, you got to spend, if you're going to spend money, like, this defense needs to be revamped. The offensive line needs help. He's had like an okay offensive line at points, but he's had mostly awful offensive lines for like his entire career.
Oh yeah, yeah. They rebuilt it that 1 year. Was it the Super Bowl year or the year after the Super Bowl?
Because the Super Bowl year like was like a miracle that
awful.
He made the Super Bowl. Like his team was
awful.
Like, in that second half of that Super Bowl, like Aaron Donald was like in the backfield on like every single play. It was
just
like
destroyed them. Yeah, and so they rebuilt it the next year and they were okay. But yeah, ever since then it's been
Both his tackles have been hurt this year, which most people won't realize. But when you look, especially when you look at his numbers, please note that his tackles are also hurt. But
it's crazy.
I think this is a pretty intriguing playoffs we're about to have. I don't think any one team is super, super dominant. I mean, the Chiefs would be that team, but they have not been that team throughout the year, although they've looked better the last few weeks. And you have, I feel like the top 3 teams in the AFC, the Chiefs, the Ravens, and the Bills, are probably pretty close in equal.
And all have star
quarterbacks. And I think that the 3 teams in the NFC, maybe 4 in the NFC, depending on how you feel about the Packers, but Vikings, Lions, Eagles, Rams, And you could even throw the Packers in too.
I don't put the Rams in that category. I think those other teams are good enough to win the three games. I don't think the Rams can win the three games.
Sure. But I feel like there's close to a similar level. The Lions obviously dealing with their injuries, kind of taking some of their momentum away. But I think it's a really good playoffs, even like from a wild card weekend perspective and divisional round. Like, I think pretty much all of the games are going to be pretty intriguing. There's a couple teams, like, I don't think the Texans are any good. And I think if the Steelers squeak in, they'll definitely be a wild card exit for them as well. But I think it's a pretty good season in terms of like balance and setting up for a really good playoffs.
It's a terrible season for drama and important games down the stretch.
This week 18. Season. Yeah.
It's a terrible week 18. It was a terrible week 16 and 17. I mean, there's just everything has been wrapped up for a while, and it's just
And then you get like, so we have Bengals Steelers tonight, which is a game worth watching, and then you have the Vikings Lions game, which is also a game worth watching. That's on Sunday.
That's
night.
About but it.
The Sunday slate itself. I'm working on Sunday, so I'm probably not going to see any of it. But I was like, I actually had tickets to this Patriots Bills game. And I was like, you know what? I got asked to work, and I could have gotten out of work if I said I had tickets to the Patriots game. But I'm like, you know what? Going to freezing Gillette Stadium to watch the terrible Patriots team play at the Bills backups in a game that doesn't matter, or a game where it actually is really important for the Patriots to actually lose in terms of draft perspective. That sounds like a bad way to spend my Sunday. So I think I'll take the work shift instead.
Well, this will certainly be a great football segment that will be totally dated by the time everybody hears it.
See, I don't think so, because we're mostly talking playoffs. We're not talking like week 18.
Yeah.
Outcome. So people will get this as already. I can't, you know, I don't know if you're going to do intelligence. Yeah, I don't have the time this upcoming week to do it, but this will serve as a thing.
Yeah, people have been asking me, but I think I'm done with football content for this year. There's just too much to do with the wrestling.
Yeah.
So.
Especially, yeah, this time of year. I think I'm going Chiefs, and I don't know. The NFC, I really find it a tough call. Like, the Lions, I think, are probably the best team, but their health is a risk. And then I'm like, then it's probably the Eagles or the Vikings. But I guess I would say the Eagles probably. But that's only really because they have a decent-ish postseason track record. You know, they've made the Super Bowl before. Like, the Vikings team, it's like, even though they're really good, like, Sam Darnold's going to make the Super Bowl. Like, it's hard for me to get in that mindset, even though he's probably deserved. He's proven that he is capable of probably doing that.
You know, it's weird because I think the Rams and the Bucks are similar in that I think they could win any isolated game, but I don't think either one of them are good enough to win three games.
Yeah, the Bucks aren't that consistent, but the Bucks, I'll tell you this, the Bucks can put up points.
Yeah, would it stun you if they beat one of those other three teams? It wouldn't stun me. I just don't think the Rams or the Bucks can win three games, but wouldn't it be funny if they met in the NFC title game and all, you know, just by virtue, because they can beat those teams, and then one of them ends up going to the Super Bowl. I think, you know, and the AFC team would be favored by at least about a touchdown, I think, over either one of those teams in the Super Bowl.
I'll say a Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold NFC championship game would be wild.
Yeah. Panthers 2 years ago.
Yeah, that one, was it a Monday night game where Mayfield played for the Rams?
It was a Thursday night game, and he came back and they signed him. He had 2 days of practice, and he beat the Raiders on a Thursday night on a last-second touchdown pass to Van Jefferson.
And that was a very lucrative game in the long run for Baker Mayfield.
I don't think he's the starting quarterback for the Bucs right now without that game.
I don't know. Obviously it's a sliding doors concept.
He didn't play great after that.
Yeah. Baker's a weird one, because I think like when you look at his career, it's like, okay, you know, really good college player, number one overall pick, really good rookie season, leads the Browns to their first playoff win where they absolutely beat the shit out of the Steelers. Like exercises all these demons, and then his career kind of falls apart in Cleveland. And then he's a journeyman.
Is the market inefficiency in the NFL discarded first try quarterbacks that didn't work out in their first stop?
Yeah, because you could say like Sam Darnold, Geno Smith,
Baker Mayfield, stop number four.
Yeah.
Is that the market inefficiency in the NFL versus, oh, we got to draft somebody in the first round? Because it feels like...
I think it's situational, right? Let's look at these situations. Like Baker is going to Tampa, which so Tampa has the last Brady year, which is undermined by a ton of injuries to the offensive line, complete inability to run the ball. They have that Brady has that wacky final season where he leads the league in pass attempts and pass completions and pass yards, but the offense didn't score any points because they couldn't do anything except like quick passes. Mayfield steps into that situation, but it's kind of the same situation that was advantageous for Brady to step into a few years before that when he left New England. Like, we've got a good offensive line with Tristan Wirfs and a couple other key players. We've got really, really good receivers, including like an absolute top star receiver in Mike Evans. And they find out a way to run the ball. And all of a sudden, this is a pretty advantageous situation for a guy. Sam Darnold, right? He goes to Minnesota where he has probably the best receiver in football. He has other good additional receivers and good tight ends. And they, you know, they sign Aaron Jones. They can run the ball again. The defense is good. I think a lot of it is these guys are talented and oftentimes they're going to crappy teams when they're drafted high and with all sorts of leadership and institutional issues. And once they get into a good situation, and if you talk to professional players, I feel like they say this all the time. Like it's about situation is so important that a lot of guys, everyone that gets drafted for the most part has the talent to be a very good player. It's, but a lot of it comes down to situation. Like, okay. Like I'm sure Patrick Mahomes would have been great any other system, but he went to the perfect place for him to succeed. That's why he's as good as he is. And I think that's true for a lot of these guys that have the talent to be good, but end up in crappy situations. And then if you're Baker, like you're journeying around, you're playing for the crappy Panthers, you're playing like a backup role for the Rams as their season's kind of falling apart a little bit. Like those aren't really great situations for you to succeed in as you're journeying around. And then, you know, he signs with Tampa. He gets an off season. He's got good weapons. He's got a good system in front of him. It's just, I think a lot of it's just situational, but if you have that situation, then, yeah, but like, I don't think if you're like the Jets or someone like that, or the Giants, like picking up one of these veteran quarterbacks that maybe flamed out somewhere isn't going to really move you forward at all because you've got so many other issues.
Yeah. And I think if you're a highly regarded quarterback getting drafted high, you're almost always going to a poor situation. So that's the,
yeah.
That,
and it's like,
get those guys.
Even like allegedly Caleb Williams was going to a great situation, right? And he was drafted number one because they had the trade and then, oh, they got these wide receivers and offensive line and blah, blah, blah. And then look what happened. So we actually get to the season and it's like, oh, maybe this situation actually isn't that great because Keenan Allen is old and the offensive line is actually not that good. And maybe Caleb Williams just isn't that good, which I think is probably a big factor as well. But you get that a lot where obviously bad teams have bad situations.
I think that, you know, when you look at Sam Darnold, Baker Mayfield, Geno Smith and guys like this, they're some of the most, I mean, these guys were completely, every one of them was completely written off and became a meme and a joke at some point. And
yeah, like Geno was really bad as a Jets quarterback.
Yeah.
And Darnold wasn't that much better. Baker at least showed the ability to be a good NFL quarterback, I think.
That position is fucking hard, man. And yeah. Sometimes it takes time. But the problem is in the modern NFL, you don't have time. You don't have 6 years to marinate a quarterback. So they have to move on and succeed somewhere else because this isn't 1973 where you could have Ken Stabler on your taxi squad for 2 years and then let him marinate for a few. There's no time for that. You just can't. It's like, you know, is Anthony Richardson going to light the league on fire in 5 years for somebody? I have my doubts, but is he any less maligned than these guys were? Now he looks way worse than any of them ever looked. Don't get me wrong. But you know, you see, there's no time for these. You get 3 years max to show that you can win, or these teams have to move on. And when you combine that with the fact that they're almost always coming into poor situations, it's so uphill.
Yeah, and you have coaches that are in the hot seat. They need this to work out. They need to show that they're moving in the right direction. I mean, this week there's a huge discussion about, like, you know, Jerod Mayo's going to play Drake May in this week 18 game. It's kind of irrelevant. Like, Patriots win, they lose they're going to probably fall in the draft, which I don't really care about that much. Some people are like freaking the fuck out about it. But to me, because we have the quarterback situation figured out, I don't care that much if we have like the first pick or the third pick. I know we can trade it for more things if we have the first pick, I guess. But like, to me, like I can't get that worked up about it.
But the other thing is, how big would that haul really be without a consensus number one quarterback?
Right. Well, we still have a long time to go where suddenly someone is popping up.
Could emerge. Yeah,
Shadar Sanders and Cam Warden. God, teams get desperate and things like that, and they make bad trades. Yeah. And we've seen that before. I mean, the Panthers traded a ton for Bryce Young. And so with that being said, but the whole point is like Mayo thinks if he beats the Bills backups, he can like his job security will be higher, which like, it's really stupid in the sense of like, you're going to beat the Bills backups in a game that doesn't matter. Like
it's stupid from our point of view, but this is a man desperately trying to cling to his first NFL coaching job. And I don't blame him for thinking that way.
No, I don't either. But people are all up in arms. And I mean, the Patriots are kind of a mess from a ownership and leadership perspective, which is what happens when you're a bad team, which is the history of the Patriots outside of a 25 year stretch there.
Yeah, I was going to lose my mind if you claimed that was a short period of time.
I was joking, but literally the most annoying thing anyone says around here these days is like an older person coming up to me and being like, you know, this is what the Patriots used to be like. Now, you know, it's something that everyone has said for like 5 years. It's unbelievably annoying.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to wrap this up. Thanks so much, Joe, for talking about John Cena and the football. We'll talk to you again after a while. Thanks. Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings, and I want to tell you all about my show, the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast, here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. On the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast, we do a thorough analysis on the biggest issues and trends within the pro wrestling industry. We talk a lot about pro wrestling media, we talk a lot about fan culture and wrestling's place within general pop culture, and we talk about the broader influences that are shaping the way we discuss and analyze the pro wrestling industry. We've had some of the brightest minds in the pro wrestling intelligentsia on the show, including WrestleNomics host Brandon Thurston, both Rich Kreich and Joe Lanza from the Flagship Wrestling Podcast, Trevor Dame from the Through the Years podcast, and a whole lot more. This isn't a show for hot takes. It's not a show recapping the latest episode of television. This is a show focusing on the biggest topics in pro wrestling and doing a deep dive on the real stories behind the surface level analysis you might find elsewhere. The Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a try. Thanks.